And good morning. Here we are on a kind of overcast, rainy Tuesday morning, Tuesday, August the 27th, 2019, 16 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into The Early Show here on WWGH Radio. We have got a couple great guests this morning, and it's going to be an interesting show for the next 2 hours, so you'll want to stay tuned. Got a few announcements. We didn't get any in yesterday with Mary Ellen Withrow being here and all the news regarding her two schools being renamed in her honor here in Marion, so I do want to get these announcements in. There'll be a neighborhood supper free meal Tuesday, September 10th, 5:15 p.m. at the Trinity Baptist Church, located at 244 South Main Street. That is the rear entrance. And the host and meal provider is Epworth United Methodist Church. The Morrill United Methodist Church, located at 206 West Neff Street in Morrill, Ohio, we'll have an old-fashioned farm breakfast, 7:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 31st, an all-you-can-eat old-fashioned farm breakfast. Will be served sausage gravy and biscuits, bacon, sausage, pancakes, scrambled eggs, home fries, all kinds of great stuff. The church is wheelchair accessible, $6 for adults, $3 for children 12 and under. The Morrill United Methodist Church, 206 West Neff Street, 7:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Saturday, August 31st. And after the breakfast, if you want something very entertaining and interesting to do, Mary Ellen Withrow, 40th Treasurer of the United States, will be having an open house at her museum Saturday, August 31st, from 2 to 4 p.m. The museum's located at 1550 Wellness Drive, Primrose, just out past the YMCA here in Marion. Free admission to the open house, and Mary Ellen will be there from 2 to 4 to take your questions on all the pictures and memorabilia in the museum. So there are three great events coming up that you're not going to want to miss. Now we turn to our guests this morning, and this is going to be an interesting time because we're bringing back a gentleman who recently left the morning airwaves here in Marion after 40 years with WMRN. Jeff Ruth and his son Brian is here this morning to talk about all the travels that they've had over the past few years and just returned from a trip. Right, Jeff?
It was actually two trips last week, did Boston and New York, and then came home for a day and went to Vegas.
Now, what'd you do in Boston and New York?
Well, for 15 years, Greg Swepston and Dave Gorenflot have organized a baseball trip. And they used to get anywhere from 20 to 25 people. A lot of them retired teachers or administrators, but just a lot of different people that like sports and baseball. And I've never done one of these trips. And Dave organized it this year, left a week ago Saturday, flew to New York, went to the Yankees-Indians game in the afternoon at Yankee Stadium, and then Saturday night saw my first Broadway show. Was just blown away. We saw the tribute to the Temptations, and I love that kind of music anyway. And just it was a great show. And then Sunday morning, got up at 5 o'clock. We took Amtrak to Boston, did the Red Sox Baltimore game Sunday afternoon, and had dinner Sunday night. And then Monday was kind of a free day in Boston and ate at a really nice restaurant Monday night in Boston. And then flew home Tuesday, and then Wednesday flew to Vegas for a couple days.
Now, you like the food in these places.
Sure.
Yeah, of course. Well, everybody does. The food is nice. Well, now, what kind of place did you go eat in Boston?
It's called Boston Legal Seafood, which turns out is the number one seafood restaurant in the country. And the prices would kind of reflect that. But it's like, because when I do a lot of the trips, we go really inexpensively. And everybody else was eating there, and of course I flew up and back for free, so it didn't cost me anything for that. And we're like four of us in a room, so our hotel rooms weren't that expensive. It was like, I'm going to just have a good dinner. So I think I had the seafood platter or whatever.
Now, obviously, Boston a lot different than New York. How would you characterize New York?
Busy all the time. We came out, the Broadway show got done It's around 11:15 on Saturday night, and we were staying at the Pennsylvania Hotel, which is right across from Grand Central Station, because we got Amtrak at Grand Central Station, so we got up Sunday morning. All we had to do was walk across the street, and walking through Times Square at 11:45 on a Saturday night, it was wall to wall people. And I was amazed at how many kids were. I mean, I'm talking 6, 8, 10-year-old kids that are there with their parents or whatever. You know, it's like midnight, and they're just out like it's, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But the constant horn honking, and we got back to our hotel, and as I said, we were right across from Times Square, and of course, that very busy place. And I don't think it ever really settled down till about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, New York, for people who haven't been there, a lot of time gets a little bit of a bad rep that there's a lot of crime and things of that nature. How do you find it in regard to that?
We've been there several times, and it's not a place I would ever want to live, but I saw more people in Boston that were, begging, or I don't know if they were homeless necessarily. Didn't see very much of that in New York. And three different times on the subway, either going to Yankee Stadium or coming back, I had somebody, offer me their seat on the subway because they thought I was old. And the subways obviously are very busy. But, three different people said, would you like my seat? Which 20 years ago, I'm not sure you would have found that.
It's interesting. When I was in New York back in 2017, it was the first time I'd ever rode the subway. What did you make of the subway?
If you can figure it out, it's fine. And Brian is really good at figuring out subways in different cities and so forth. But since I was with a big group, we all knew, and I just kind of followed what everybody else was doing. But it can be confusing. If you have to take the orange line to 42nd Street and then change to the yellow line, and then you take that five stops to get off to the green line to go to Yankee Stadium, it can be really confusing.
Now, Boston. What kind of city would you characterize Boston?
A lot of history in Boston. We stayed Sunday night. It was the Constitution Inn, which is right on the water, and right by the aquarium, kind of the downtown area, but it wasn't in the heart of downtown. It was away a few blocks, but we got back Sunday night around 9:30, and I just kind of walked around the hotel. Very quiet, even though you're only several blocks from downtown Boston. Where we were, it was just very quiet. They still had the old brick brick streets and so forth, and the USS Constitution's there, and much more history obviously in Boston. The Freedom Trail, which a lot of people did on Monday, and very historical.
Now, this was a group trip, right?
Group trip.
Now, when we say affordable for a group trip, what neighborhood are we in to do something like this?
For me, and again, I didn't have to pay to fly up and back, and I was only on the trip for like half the time, but Saturday, the Yankee game tickets were $55 for the Yankee game Saturday. Sunday, the Boston tickets, those were $90. I thought those were kind of steep. The Broadway show was, I think, $99. So the two baseball tickets, the Broadway show, and then the trip from New York to Boston on Amtrak, and might have been something else included, was $475.
Now, $90...
Or in the two nights in the hotel.
Now, the $90 to see the Boston Red Sox. Now, was that place full?
It was... there were a lot of people there. It wasn't full. Boston's not having a real good season. And Baltimore is like the worst team in baseball. If they had been playing the Yankees or maybe Cleveland or somebody like that, there would have been a lot more people. There were still 30,000 plus people, but I'd say there were you know, 3,000 or 4,000 empty seats.
Because what is it to see the Reds now? Like $15? It's not very expensive.
No, it's not.
No. And what do you think that's based on, even though the Red Sox aren't having a great year?
Well, the Red Sox pay a lot of money to get a lot of the free. Same thing with the Yankees. I mean, they pay a lot of money to get a lot of the players, and they have to obviously get the money from somewhere. So, and Fenway Park and Yankee Stadium is kind of the same thing. You get people, you know, from all over the area. That's kind of on their bucket list, a lot like Wrigley Field. People want to go to see a game in Fenway Park. I've always wanted to see a game in Boston. So, you know, people will maybe pay more to see a game in Boston than they would in Kansas City or Milwaukee.
Being a sports guy and that close being in both stadiums, who has the more rampant fans, the more into it fans, Red Sox or the Yankees? There's a rivalry there.
Just on based on what I saw, the Yankees on Saturday, because they had over 50,000, and they were playing the Indians, and there were a lot of Cleveland fans there. And, of course, most of us were, you know, rooting for Cleveland. And there was a lot of banter back and forth. I mean, none of it was of a nasty nature. It was like, boy, was, you know, a lot of people came in for, you know, how'd you get here and that kind of thing. So at least from where the area we were sitting, I would say the Yankee fans were. But, again, Yankees are in first place. Have, if not the best record in baseball, one of the best records. And again, Boston's struggling. They're kind of out of the playoff picture.
So you come back and then head off to Las Vegas.
Well, last Monday was a free day in Boston. So we left. They were going to do a tour of Fenway Park Monday morning, the other 20 people. So I left Monday morning. I've only had this happen a couple times. I was going to fly back Monday from Boston to Columbus, and then we were going to go to Vegas on Tuesday morning. So, Brian, you pick up the story here. Everything basically from Boston to Columbus was full. So he had me going to Pittsburgh, to Detroit, to Raleigh, to – he had about six different cities. So I went down to each – you know, at 210, kind of explain how you know when there's a seat available. But basically, I spent from 8 o'clock Saturday or 8 o'clock Monday morning till 6 o'clock Monday night not getting out of Boston, calling Dave after I realized that I was stuck in Boston Monday night. There was nothing coming back. So I took the subway. That's where I met everybody Monday night. We had dinner. Then I went back to the subway. So I spent the night at the airport in Boston and flew out Tuesday.
And all employees for Delta can access what we call TravelNet. And on TravelNet, it gives us an up-to-date or up-to-a-minute how many seats are available on an aircraft. And you can judge on how many seats are left. If a flight has 30 open seats, you're pretty much good to go. The problem is sometimes you may get employees that have higher seniority than myself. So if someone – I got hired into Delta in 2015 – so somebody with higher seniority of 2012, 2011, they go ahead of us on the standby list. So you may have about 10 or 15 open seats, but you might be 17 or 18 on standby. So then it gets kind of interesting. Hopefully, you know, a couple of people misconnect, show up late, and you'll be able to get on. The Northeast, and for any airline, the Northeast, Boston, New York, Philly, Washington, we at work, we call it, you know, when it goes to crap. And that's a lot of days, especially in the afternoon and evenings. You always get what we call ground delay programs. So if you get some weather that is it's not even in New York, but it's maybe 50 miles away, 60 miles away, air traffic control has to redirect aircrafts to land in these different airports. And so you, in order to line up, Columbus to LaGuardia is not a high priority route that, you know, they're trying to get all these international planes in and all these major cities in. So Columbus is kind of low in the priorities. And so what happens is, you know, the plane may be delayed an hour, hour and a half for takeoff. And then once they get off the ground, it's amazing how these planes line up. Air traffic control, they can tell by the second on when a plane from Columbus takes off and goes to New York, at what point he's going to line up to go into landing in LaGuardia. So it's kind of interesting how air traffic control can dictate the time. But in the afternoon and evening, especially when air traffic gets more frequent, more backed up and stuff, you get ground delay programs. But any kind of weather in the Northeast just throws everything off. And Sunday evening, I know they were calling for weather in the Northeast on Monday. So airlines had started contacting passengers on Monday who were flying out to see if they wanted to go on earlier flights on Sunday. So you start getting that where flights start filling up on Sunday, and then anticipation for maybe delays or cancellations on Monday. So what happened was Monday morning, Jeff was on his way to the airport, and I noticed that flights are, you know, filling up, and we had a nonstop from Boston back to Columbus at 2:15. He got to Boston about 11 o'clock in the morning, and I said, you know, let's try for Raleigh-Durham. That way he can fly from Boston to Raleigh. I had about a five-hour layover in Raleigh, then gets into Columbus. Well, flight was full. He wasn't able to get out. Then I had him try Pittsburgh. I had him try Raleigh again, and then I had him try the nonstop to Columbus, and that didn't work. So I said, we have a 8:15 in the evening flight back to Columbus. I said, it's showing zero seats right now, but I said, you might be in a good situation where you might be able to get the flight. And I'm at work at this time, and all of a sudden I got the notification that the flight from Boston to from Columbus to Boston had been canceled, which turns out to be the flight from Boston to Columbus. So I called him immediately and I said, you know, get a hold of the group. I said, you're not going to be flying out tonight, you'll be flying out tomorrow morning, so you know, see what you can do from there.
He actually had to fly last Tuesday. He caught the early flight from Columbus to Boston because as an employee's family member, you're at the lowest of the low. So I probably couldn't have gotten out last Tuesday morning. And so he flew up Tuesday morning to meet me. And then 20 minutes later, he gets back in the plane, and then we fly back to Columbus. And originally, we were going to go Tuesday, go nonstop. There's a flight from Boston to Vegas. We were going to do that, and it's like spending all night in the airport. And of course, you can't sleep in an airport. And it's like, let's just go on Wednesday, because when we had gotten there, plus Boston to Vegas is a long flight, and we would have been tired. So we just ended up going out on Wednesday.
So when you finally did get to Las Vegas, what was your experience there?
We love Vegas. We try and go a couple times a year. Get there in the afternoon, you walk around, grab something to eat in the evening. He got a real good deal at the Excalibur, $38 a night. And you can get really good rates during the, like, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and even Monday a little bit. Now, you know, that $38 room might be $250 on the weekend. But during the week, there's so many hotels out there. So we can go spend, you know, a day or two in Vegas for between $50 and $100, which isn't too bad.
Now, if you are going on a trip, and let's say you're going during the week, what's the best way to find a good hotel rate in a city?
I use hotels.com, and airline employees would get a 10% off discount off of that. But, you know, the farther you look out, so if you're booking a trip 5-6 months in advance, you might be able to get a better rate than getting a hotel the night before or the day of. But in essence, if hotels are trying to fill their rooms, they may drop the price at, you know, the last day of, you know, before you fly out, and you know, I can get a good rate then. It's hotel prices often during the week are cheaper, but if you're looking to book hotels, I would recommend going to about 4 or 5 different websites: Expedia, Travelocity, Booking.com, Trivago. There's a lot of these websites where you can just compare, and it's amazing how prices can differ $5 to $10 per room based on these different websites. Now, unfortunately, if you know, you book through a third-party website and you get into an issue with the hotel, they may not refund, you know, all your money, you know, unless if you book through the company themselves. But, you know, any hotel, even car rentals, even airline prices are even based on, I mean, you know, do your shopping 4 or 5 different websites and see what you can do.
Now, has there ever been a time where you've ended up in a place where you, there were no cheaper hotel rooms and you had to pay some kind of astronomical rate?
One time we flew, we're going to go to Hawaii one time, and we ended up flying to Burlington, Vermont, believe it or not.
On this story, because shortly after he got the job, we wanted to go to Alaska and Hawaii because those are pretty expensive to get there. So we did Alaska in the spring, and when we did Alaska, we're going to go to Hawaii. And Columbus has a nonstop from L.A. to Columbus, leaves L.A. about 10:30 at night and gets into Columbus about 6 in the morning. And then it leaves Columbus and goes to L.A. at about 7 in the morning. So Brian, and it was on a Monday morning, and we were like first and second on standby. We'll be good, because normally there's a few people or a couple people that don't show up. Well, that particular Monday morning, everybody showed up. And we were disappointed because we wanted to go to Hawaii. So it's like, well, we can go to New York, and then we can take the direct flight from New York to Honolulu. All right, let's do that. So we're going to New York, and it's like, by the time the plane left New York and got to Hawaii, it would have been like midnight Monday night. And by leaving early, we were going to be there at noon or so. So we lost the whole 12 hours there. You know, Honolulu, New York to Honolulu, that's a long, long flight. So it's like, nah, let's not do that. We'll go some other time. Let's go someplace else. Well, where haven't we been? Let's pick a place we haven't been. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont. So we flew to Burlington and rented a car and then went up to Montreal and Quebec City and kind of did that area. And the hotel, or well, not a hotel, it's a motel of probably 30 rooms or whatever. But we were so tired because we got up, you know, 4 in the morning or whatever, and it's like 11 o'clock Monday night. And we're driving between Montreal and Quebec City. We had no idea where we were. And Brian, like, we can hardly keep our eyes open. So we got off the exit and got some motel or whatever. And it was like $130 or whatever. And it's like, you could spend 3 nights in Vegas for, you know, for this. So that was probably the one where we really spent way too much money. But we were just so tired.
Now, what is in Burlington, Vermont?
Well, there's a capital. The capital's there. Or no, the capital's in Montpelier. But Ben and Jerry's has their headquarters is in Vermont. So we did a tour of the Ben and Jerry's ice cream facility. And we got a, you know, free ice cream cone at the end. We toured the capital in
Montpelier,
which isn't very far away.
Montpelier is actually an interesting city because it has one or two stoplights in the whole city. So even Marion is bigger than the state capital of Vermont. And Montpelier is actually the smallest state capital for population in the whole country.
And it's the only state capital that does not have a McDonald's.
Really?
Yes. They don't have a McDonald's in Montpelier.
Now, is there a reasoning for that? Just a healthy area?
I don't know.
We like our Ben and Jerry's. We don't have time for this.
I don't know the reason for that, but yeah. So that was kind of interesting. And we were going to Hawaii, and this was around spring break, maybe end of March. And, of course, all we had were shorts, and we ended up going to Vermont and Montreal, and there was still snow on the ground.
Well, that's a question I had, is when you pack for one of these trips and you think you're going to Hawaii and you end up in Vermont, that's a little different.
It is.
Yeah.
And we just, in fact, that's one of his complaints, is people pack so much. When we go, and we'll usually go like for 4 days or whatever, counting the travel time, you know, I'll take a couple pair of pants, a couple of shirts. You don't need a whole lot. And so we pack very lightly, but it's amazing how many people, you know, pack probably five times what they really need.
And I mean, I was guilty of that. We went on a cruise, a family cruise in 2001, and I remember packing, you know, it was a 7-day cruise, and, you know, packing 55, 60 pounds of clothes, you know, in a bag. And dealing with, you know, baggage day in and day out, you know, the one bag that stood out a couple of weeks ago, I was loading a bag going to Las Vegas, and it was a 71-pound bag. And I'm like, it's 110 degrees in Vegas. Why are we packing, you know, 70-some pounds of clothes going to Vegas? But also, the flight that's one of the worst flights and probably the worst, I would say the worst place to work would be JFK. We have a JFK flight that leaves at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the flight seats 76 people, and we get it's not unusual to get 100 bags on this aircraft. And a lot of bags that go to Africa, goes to Ghana, goes to Nigeria, Lagos. And so what these people do is actually they go to Walmart or a local store here in Columbus, and they go buy clothes, shoes, and they pack bags full of merchandise, send it over to Ghana, and there's people waiting on the other side that pick it up, and then they turn around and quadruple the price off the streets that people buy, and then that's how they make profit. And it's amazing, they buy tickets on an aircraft seats, but these people never go. They always just send bags. So it was kind of interesting to see that. And then what happens is now Delta kind of cracked down on that a couple of years ago. So now you have to have the person going to that destination with that bag. So you may have a person come in and check 10, 15 bags just for one person. And I mean, talking to the people up at the gate, I mean, these people spend $2,000-$3,000 on just baggage fees alone. And I work down what we call below wing. So I deal with baggage, mail, freight, and we get a lot of we deal with a lot of exotic animals. Jack Hanna, who used to go a lot on the Anderson Cooper show down in Atlanta, and you know, he would get, they'd bring baby kangaroos down, you know, and also when he was in, on the David Letterman show in New York. And, so we get a lot of, we got a lot of exotic animals. We've had kangaroos, we've had, baby cheetahs that come in. So it's kind of interesting seeing that. We deal with a lot of, pets, a lot of cats, a lot of dogs, and, mail. We have a lot of mail, and then during the holiday season, we get a lot of boxes from that get shipped to Guatemala and stuff. So we deal with a lot of we deal with a lot more stuff than just bags down below.
So how much room do you have?
So it depends on the type of aircraft. We work regionals, which go to Detroit, New York. You can pack maybe 100 bags in some of these aircrafts, but then the bigger aircrafts to Atlanta, to LA, to Minneapolis, we can, I would say a 737-900, which has about 180 passengers, you can easily load in 300, 350 bags plus freight. And that's just in the front compartment. We have so many compartments on these bigger aircrafts. So we consistently, on the first flight to LA in the morning, we have about 3,000 pounds of mail that they send out. Mm-hmm. And one time coming back from Anchorage, Alaska, we ended up getting bumped off of an aircraft due to weight and balance issues because they were hauling 18,000 pounds of salmon. So you can haul a lot of freight plus bags at the same time on a lot of these bigger aircrafts.
On that flight, that was like about the first flight that I had ever, after we got the job, we wanted to go to Alaska. So it was around Memorial Day. So we flew up, came back. We were going to come back Thursday night. Anchorage to Minneapolis, Minneapolis to Columbus. And we had to spend the night at the airport. I think only there's been three times where we actually had to spend a day or a night at the airport. We couldn't get out. Everything for that weekend was booked because all of this, of course, is standby. So we ended up, we got an early morning flight to Salt Lake City. We waited about 8 hours in Salt Lake City for something to open up to Atlanta. So we get to Atlanta about 11 o'clock Friday night. There's one seat on the last flight to Columbus, and they also had a late flight to Dayton. So Brian said, you take the flight to Columbus because the car was at the airport. I'll go to Dayton. You come pick me up, and then we'll go home. So I took that last, you know, if there wasn't one seat available, and so many of these flights, it comes down to like one seat or two seats. So I did that. He flew to Dayton. I drove to Dayton, got there about 15 minutes after he did, and we came back to Mary. So you have to have a lot of flexibility.
When you were working, was there ever an issue with trying to get back and you thought you weren't going to make it?
I'm trying to remember.
I like to try to get, especially working for myself, I like to get back a day or two in advance. So I think kind of with him, you know, we wanted to get back at least a day ahead of time.
He works weekends primarily. He'll do like a double shift Saturday and Sunday. So when we go, we usually go Monday morning. And if I was going to take the week, we'd get back by Friday night. So it really wasn't – I don't know that I ever missed a day because of travel. Because
we've done a couple of day trips. We've flown down to Savannah, Georgia, you know, Fort Myers, Florida. And there you have to connect through Atlanta. So not only do you have just two flights, but you have to have four flights, you know, one to and from Atlanta and then Atlanta to Savannah. So you kind of get nervous in that situation because you know that he needs to be back the next morning. So all it takes is just one aircraft to be late on maintenance or, you know, any type of situation and, you know, you're screwed and he's calling, you know, hey, I can't make it tomorrow morning. You know, somebody needs to fill in for me. So you're kind of nervous in that.
A guy that he works with was in Honolulu, couldn't get back to the mainland. It was full for like the next 3 or 4 days. He ended up going Honolulu to Tokyo, Tokyo to Seattle, Seattle to Detroit, Detroit to Columbus. Now, the average person isn't going to be able to do that or know that, but he knew that, you know, it was wide open to Tokyo, and Tokyo to Seattle was wide open, So he could have spent 3 or 4 days in Hawaii waiting for a seat to open up. This way, you know, how many people are going to fly to Tokyo to come to the U.S. from Hawaii? Nobody. But when you're an employee, you know, and you can kind of fit the pieces of the puzzle together.
You know, it's interesting. I was having a conversation with somebody last night, and they had a fear of flying. What could you say to somebody to put their nerves or mind at ease when it comes to flying?
I feel a lot safer flying than I do driving from Marion to Columbus. I mean, I notice a lot of passengers when I fly that, you know, especially if they have a window seat or something, you know, the shades are down. You know, they do get a little nervous, but it's by far, you know, the safest mode of travel. Like I said, I'd rather fly, you know, from Columbus to Los Angeles. I feel a lot safer than I do, you know, driving. There's been some turbulent issues we've had flying. You get some choppiness flying over the Atlantic Ocean sometimes, going transatlantic over to Europe. One of the worst I had was back in earlier this year. We flew, went out to the Rose Bowl to see Ohio State play Washington, and then we had to fly from LA to Vegas and then Vegas to Atlanta. And we got around, they had storms up around the southeast area, and it was pretty bad for about 15-20 minutes of just nothing but turbulence. But I mean, usually there's no issues. Air traffic control kind of dictates how to go around the turbulence and stuff.
Like when we went to New York, we actually, instead of going basically along I-70, we actually go up over Lake Erie north of Cleveland and go up through over Erie and Buffalo and come down that way, which seems, I mean, it just seems twice as far, but that's how they send you from Columbus to New York.
Mm. What would you say, aside from the free travel, is the best thing about working for the airline?
I just, my coworkers, there's about 50 of us, 60 of us that work on the ramp, and we all get along great. It's not a stressful job. You know, I mean, all you basically do is load and unload aircrafts. But in the wintertime, it does get frustrating because, and I mean, you have individuals that work on the ramp that love to de-ice. They love to de-ice the aircrafts. You know, anytime there's a, you know, there's a big snow event and you need to go out there, boom, they're out there de-icing. I am not a big fan. If I get called to de-ice, I'd rather be driving the truck. 70 degrees, I got the heater on, you know, and everything. Driving the truck, you have to communicate with the crew. You have to communicate with the guy in the bucket on, you know, what we're doing and stuff. So you got a lot more responsibility than just being out in a bucket and spraying an aircraft. You get to cities like Minneapolis and Detroit, they're enclosed buckets up there, and people bid on that during the wintertime where, you know, they're wearing shorts and a t-shirt because it's 75, 80 degrees in the bucket, and they're spraying aircrafts for 8 hours a day. So you get people that like to do that. I myself hate it. It's just, it's a pain, you know, and especially when it's 5, 10 degrees outside and 15-20 below wind chill, and you're in a bucket, you know, outside with the elements, it kind of gets to be a pain.
Now, what is a typical schedule like in a given week?
So each schedule varies by month. We get a new schedule each month. Of course, the summertime is busier. We average on about 35 departures a day for Delta and 34-35 arrivals a day. We are the second busiest airline out of Columbus. Actually, when American Airlines merged with, I believe, US Air, or United, one of the American, United, something like that, we took the second spot. Southwest also is a big carrier out of Columbus. So it's kind of close out of those three carriers in Columbus. So the morning shift and on Sundays, I go in at 4:30 a.m. and I work till 6:30 p.m. So I work 14 hours on a day in a day. And on Sundays, our first flight's at 5:45 a.m. So I start at 4:30 in the morning. I go down to what we call a bag room. So what happens is when a passenger comes in to an airport and they go to a kiosk, they print out a ticket, and let's say they have a bag, they go to the ticket counter. Ticket counter puts a bag tag on the bag, puts it on a belt. The bag then goes from there through TSA. So TSA examines it, makes sure there's nothing explosive or anything in there. And then it goes into what we call a bag room. And a bag room is in the bag room, we sort the bags. So if a bag is going to Seattle and it's going through Minneapolis, we are putting it on a Minneapolis cart. And then what happens is that once that plane gets to about an hour prior to departure, we are taking that cart out to that Minneapolis aircraft, and then they're loading that bag onto that aircraft. And then once that aircraft gets to Minneapolis, then it goes through different what we call transfer runners. People pick up bags, and then they run them to another gate, which is where that plane is going from Minneapolis to Seattle. July 6th, I believe, was a Sunday after July 4th this year. When I was in the bag room for 14 hours that day, I had just over 5,000 bags that just came down in just that one day alone. And so we do have a lot of bags that that we do handle. Working out on the ramp, so that's in the bag room. Working on the ramp, I would be assigned a team, and there's three or four of us to a team. So we work about four or five different aircrafts during the afternoon, and so you get a plane coming in from Atlanta, and he's coming in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Comes in maybe 10 minutes early at 1:50. You could see how many bags are off, how many freight, how much freight's coming off. So you may have about 110, 115 bags coming off the aircraft and about 100 bags going on. And we have about 50 minutes to turn it. So 45 to 50 minutes is the required time. And so once the plane gets on the ground, taxis to the gate, it's hustle time for us because we don't want to take a delay on the ramp. And that goes against us as a station. So it's kind of, coordinating with the other two or three employees on the team. Hey, what are we doing here? Who's getting in the bin? Who's doing this? Who's hooking up the pushback and all that? So we had an instance where we've had a lot of planes go on maintenance. I hate to say it, but if people wouldn't see what kind of maintenance logs goes with aircrafts, I don't know if they would want to fly. But again, a lot of it is like, oh, okay, well, we have a broken bin on an aircraft. Someone put a heavy bag in an overhead compartment and then the compartment ended up busting or something. So then they have to get Tate to come out and fix it. I mean, it's no big deal. But we've had some aircrafts that sit overnight. We've had a lot of, there's been days where like Detroit goes on, bad weather. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was not working that day, but we had a diversion. 30 seconds. We had a diversion come from Shanghai to, it was going from Shanghai to Detroit, diverted to Columbus. So it's kind of interesting to, get that and some people, and then the flight ended up turning around in an hour and flying back to Detroit. Mm-hmm.
Jeff and Brian Ruth are the guests this morning. They'll be here for another hour. We're going to talk about overseas travel. How did Brian get in this field? And a whole lot of other stuff. You're tuned in to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Ohio, the talking place. For people like the first female Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright.
If Donald Trump does get in, what kind of damage could he do? He's got to deal with Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court. From somebody who's been there and dealing with foreign countries, if he's in there, what could there be a bad future?
I'm concerned about that. I have said that if he gets elected, it is a danger to the United States. The truth is, in many ways, the kinds of things that he's saying in the campaign is a danger to the United States. The United States, for our national interest and the